I think it was the winter before last. I don't see Kelly in the room. I think it was winter before last that Olivia was playing, or maybe it was last winter, I suppose. Olivia was playing Y basketball. You know how it is when fourth graders play basketball. Fourth grade girls, no less. That was not nice, was it? But we went to several of those games, and I watched one Saturday morning with bemusement. As another player, not my granddaughter, of course, as another player, another girl, dribbled that ball for all she was worth down toward the other team's goal. And very little defense, of course, because that's the way it is when you're fourth and fifth grade girls playing basketball. And thankfully, she missed the shot. That was going to be a disaster in a game that, you know, they have scores like 4-2 at the end of the game. Having spent a good part of my week this week in Esther chapter 5, I'm beginning to get a sneaking suspicion that Haman is about to make a basket at the Jews' end of the court. But I can't be sure about that tonight because, as you know by now, I steadfastly refuse to go beyond the end of chapter 5, so I don't have any idea what's going to happen after that. At least that's the impression I'm trying to leave myself. I just sort of have this sneaking suspicion it's not going to end well for Haman. When we got to the end of chapter 4 of Esther last Sunday night, Esther was fasting, as were all the Jews in Susa. Remember, Susa is the winter administrative capital of Persia. Mordecai was clothed in sackcloth. Ahasuerus and Haman at the end of chapter 4 were doing what? Having a drink, enjoying a drink together. They were just really doing well. And the Jewish population of Persia was preparing to be hunted in 11 months. Well, there's a significant change of scene as we turn to chapter 5 tonight of Esther. This talk of fasting from chapter 4 turns quickly to a talk of feasting. And Esther, her maneuvers become very carefully planned. Suddenly the pace slows way down. It's almost as if there's no danger that these events are going to get carried away and take off on their own. Esther, even as we see in chapter 5, is going to keep delaying the implementation of her plan. I found myself, by the time I got to the end of chapter 5, and I think you will too, wondering if, let alone when, and certainly how, this is all going to turn out. Well, Esther 5 centers around a banquet. We get 4.5 verses preparing for a banquet. We get another 3.5 verses at the banquet, and then another 6 verses after the party. Let me begin with you with that preparation for the banquet. I'll read just verse 1 of Esther chapter 5, and then we need to sort of set the scene. Esther chapter 5, verse 1. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's quarters while the king was sitting on his royal throne inside the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. This is the third day of what? Third day of fasting. Remember, Esther asked Mordecai to ask all the Jews in Susa to fast for 3 days, day and night, which was pretty radical. I don't think I could imagine what that's like to fast 3 days, day and night. And she's standing here in front of the king's quarters while the king is on his royal throne. Why is she standing there? She's what? Hoping he'll notice her. Why doesn't she just walk on in? She's the queen. It's against the law of the Persians. So the law is, if the king does not summon you and you enter his presence, you're likely as not just to be killed on the spot. And Esther has warned Mordecai about how dangerous it is for her to approach the king. After all, she's not been called into his presence for a month now, even though she is the queen. And you'll remember also that Ahasuerus, the king of Persia, a.k.a. Xerxes, Ahasuerus has a bit of a volatile streak to his personality, do you think? He seems to be a man who is prone to weird things, sort of unexpected things. Gary Smith, in a commentary on Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther, said this: people who hope to be used by God must boldly put themselves in a position where God can work through them, rather than sitting back, doing nothing, passively hoping or waiting for God to do something. If you want to be used by God, you're going to have to take a risk. You can sit there quietly in the corner and be a wallflower, but you won't be used by God. Serving God involves risk, and it certainly was going to do that for Esther. Praise God that Esther didn't respond with, "I'll pray about this opportunity to serve, Pastor. Oh, if I had a nickel for every time I asked somebody, would you be willing to do this? Well, I'll have to pray about it." No, come on. You're available. You have the requisite skills. It needs to be done. Why does everybody need to pray about it? I'm glad that she didn't say that. Well, 5 centuries after Esther, the Lord Jesus Christ, anticipating his arrest and crucifixion in Jerusalem, Luke says this. This is Luke 9:51. When the days drew near for him to be taken up, he set his face to go up to Jerusalem. So our Lord set his face to go to Jerusalem, anticipating the risk, knowing the danger, knowing what would happen to him there, because that was all part of God's plan for our redemption. Praise God that Jesus Christ, that he followed the Father's plan to redeem us. So may I just encourage you, when you have an opportunity to serve, understand there is risk, there is cost, I got that, but choose to lean into serving God, even when there is risk and cost. Every opportunity we're given by God is an opportunity to believe in his promises, to trust in his provision, to rely on his strength. So don't be scared of serving him, even though it seems like maybe there is a danger in that. Enough of that. The moment of truth. What's going to happen? She's standing outside the court. Verse 2. When the king saw Queen Esther. By the way, she's just been Esther for a while. Now she's Queen Esther. When the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won favor in his sight. And he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. She's in. That's goodness. That's good to see. Esther has won Ahasuerus' favor. We've seen that phrase before. Take a look back at chapter 2, verse 9. Esther seems to have a knack for winning people's favor. Chapter 2, verse 9. You remember she's in this competition to be chosen queen. Chapter 2, verse 9, this is Esther with the official in charge of the women, the young woman, verse 9 of chapter 2, the young woman, that is Esther, pleased him, that's Haggai, and won his favor. He quickly provided her with special preparations. Look at verse 15 of the same chapter. Chapter 2, verse 15, when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his own daughter. When a turn came for Esther to go into the king, she asked for nothing except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who had charge of the women, advised. Now Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her. And finally, verse 17. Chapter 2, verse 17, Esther goes into the king, and the response, the king loved Esther more than all the other women. She won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen. So Esther has this knack for winning favor from people around her. Well, now that Esther has been granted an audience with the king, what will she do? Will she spill the beans? Will she tell the tale about how Haman has plotted for the destruction of her people? How will this turn out? Well, let's look at verse 3. Esther chapter 5, verse 3. The king said to her, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given you even to half of my kingdom." Half of my kingdom. Is this just rhetoric? Because after all, if Ahasuerus does this twice, he doesn't have any kingdom left. Unless you think the first time he gets rid of half, and the next time half of that half, and the next time half of that half. And if I was a calculus student, I could figure out how many times he could do that before he has nothing left. I don't know whether Ahasuerus really intends to give away up to half of his kingdom, or if this is just a rhetorical thing. Here's what I do know. Herodotus, the Greek historian, says this, that Ahasuerus, in another instance, another time, extended the same offer to one of his daughters-in-law, up to half of my kingdom, whatever, what do you want, up to half of my kingdom. And it happened to be that that daughter-in-law was also his lover and also his niece. And you thought your family was messed up. So this was apparently a piece of, if it is rhetoric, rhetoric which comes up over and over again, I don't really know, but he's certainly letting Esther know, letting Queen Esther know that he intends to be generous in granting her request. So now what will she do? What will Esther do now that the king has said, I'll give you whatever you want? She should immediately say, evil, wicked Haman has plotted for the murder of my people, for the genocide, there's the word, I knew it was something side. He's plotted for the genocide of the Jews, but that's not what she does. This is time for some strategization. I was thinking about that this afternoon. We're at a Constitution Revision Committee thinking about making up words, which apparently Doug and Phyllis are prone to do. So we're going to strategize here. Esther needs to engage in some strategization. Look at verse 4. Esther said, if it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a feast that I've prepared for the king. And the king said, bring Haman quickly so we may do as Esther has asked. The beginning of what seems to be a dramatic anticlimax happens here in verse 4. How can Ahasuerus say no? I mean, she already has prepared the meal, right? I want the king and Haman to come today to a feast that I have already prepared, verse 4, for the king. How can he possibly say no to her invitation to come to the dinner? And Ahasuerus seems amazingly eager. He says in verse 5, hurry up, get Haman, let's go do what Esther says. Perhaps flattery does, after all, get you somewhere. We've heard flattery will get you nowhere. I don't think that's quite true. Flattery will get you all sorts of places. So now we're going to find ourselves at the party. Let me read for you the rest of verse 5 down through the end of verse 8. If you think about where we are, you would see the caption above the scene. Later that day, verse 5, middle of the verse. So the king and Haman came to the feast that Esther had prepared. And as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king said to Esther, what is your wish? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to half of my kingdom it shall be fulfilled. Then Esther answered, my wish and my request is... I don't know whether to... My Bible has a colon at the end of verse 7, as if verse 8 is her request. But I almost tend to read this in a way that says, my wish and my request is... And then she breaks off and then picks up again and says, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my wish and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come to the feast that I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I'll do as the king has said. Pretty crafty, really. So now that Ahasuerus has his belly full, verse 6, and repeats his earlier offer, I expect Esther to spill her guts about Haman's evil edict. But then she doesn't. I don't know if she's starting to do that in verse 7 or if this is all part of her plan, but she doesn't tell him her request. And I suppose this gets Ahasuerus' curiosity up. He's now all the more eager to hear her request, to grant her request. And she says to him there in verse 8, you can do what you have promised to do. That is, you can grant my request. You just have to come to the feast again tomorrow. Come to dinner here again tomorrow with Haman, of course. Are you happy to see Esther strategizing? Do you like that? Does that seem right to you? Take a look with me at Matthew chapter 10. I don't know whether I should like the idea that she's plotting. Well, she's plotting. The progress is going amazingly slow, but she's also plotting as she goes. Matthew chapter 10, verse 16. When you think about the way that Esther is arranging the events of the day and of the following day in a very purposeful manner, reminded me of Jesus' statement to his disciples in Matthew 10, where he says in verse 16, Matthew chapter 10, verse 16, "Behold, I am sending you out as sheep in the midst of wolves." It's a very dangerous time. "So be wise as serpents and innocent as doves." So Jesus certainly, I think, gives an attaboy to the idea of planning carefully. If you were heading to some limited access country where you hoped to distribute Bibles, you probably don't have to tell everything that you know at the border crossing. I'm not advocating that you deceive in terms of telling lies. That seems outside the bounds of what God allows. But you don't have to tell everything you know. When God sent Samuel to anoint David as king, and Samuel says, "What if Saul finds out?" God said to Samuel, "Take along a cow. And when you get there, if questions are asked, saying, 'I've come to offer sacrifice,'" which is true if you have a cow. If you don't take a cow, you probably can't say that. I think it's legit for Esther to be sort of arranging the situation, just as Jesus clearly gives credibility to that in Matthew chapter 10. I'm going to stop on my way back to Esther at Proverbs 21. You can stop there with me if you want to. I just want to read one verse, the first verse of Proverbs 21. Just in case you're so inclined, I'll give you a moment. If you're not turning there, if you're going immediately back to Esther, just hang out there and wait for us. We'll be back. Proverbs 21:1. Solomon says this: "The king's heart is a stream of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he will." Just remember here, God is sovereignly arranging. Esther is being used as a tool in his hand. God is sovereignly arranging the situation to benefit his people. Back in Esther chapter 5, by the time we get to the end of verse 8, Haman has been invited to a banquet with the queen and the king. And now we get to the end of that first banquet, and Haman's been invited back the next day to a banquet with the queen and the king. And he is flying high. He is just walking home with a spring in his step and a smile on his face. What could possibly spoil such a great mood? Don't tell me you know already. You're not supposed to be reading ahead. I suspect that Esther is not the only one making plans. By the time we get to the end of chapter 5, you'll see that somebody else is making plans as well. So we move from later that day to even later that day, when we get to verses 9 and following. Let me read the rest of the chapter, beginning in verse 9. I will stop, though, before I get to verse 14. Don't read ahead. Verse 9. "Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that Mordecai neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and brought his friends and his wife Zeresh. And Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and servants of the king. Then Haman said, 'Even Queen Esther, let no one but me come with the king to the feast she prepared, and tomorrow also I'm invited by her together with the king. Yet all this is worth nothing to me, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate.'" What a change in his attitude. A rather emotional roller coaster experience for Haman this day. Certainly not what I was expecting. Haman skipping along. But joy is short-lived for a man like Haman. He's a bit egocentric. He's a megalomaniac. Landon Dowden, I'll read you just an excerpt from his commentary on Esther in a minute. Landon Dowden compares Haman's joy to fool's gold. You know, as a kid, we had limestone in the driveway before my mother had it paved eventually. And you'd find these sparkly rocks. It's like, "Wow, look what I found." "No, it's just a rock. It's just a worthless piece of driveway rock." And that's the way Haman's joy is. He sees Mordecai sitting in the king's gate, and Mordecai, when Haman comes by, does not stand up. He does not bow down. He doesn't even seem fearful. And that really irritates Haman, that Mordecai is so nonplussed by Haman. Amazingly, Haman keeps his cool long enough to get home. On the way, he pulls out his phone and sends a group text. Sends a group text to all of his friends and to his wife. Here's what the text says. Come to my party this afternoon so I can let you know how awesome I am. So we find Haman there in verses 10 and 11 telling his advisors, his friends, and his wife stuff they already know. These people know all this stuff, but somehow it makes Haman feel good to tell his story, to tell how much money he has, how much stuff he has, to tell how many sons he has. How many sons do you think Haman has? Did you read ahead? Haven't we talked about this? Heather. A bunch, I'm sure. Does Haman have a bit of a pride problem? Just a tiny bit. In the middle of a long line, Haman finds himself in the middle of a long line of famous biblical characters who thought they were somebody and found out they weren't. Remember Pharaoh? King Pharaoh, Exodus 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. What happens to him? Plague, 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 plague. Red Sea, drowning. Pharaoh started off thinking he was somebody, but by the time God's done with him, he finds out he's not. You remember Sihon and Og, the kings of the Amorites and the people of Bashan in Numbers 21? They thought they were hot stuff and going to oppose the Israelites while they made their way to Canaan. God demonstrated just what they were about. How about Balak? Remember Balak, king of the Moabites, hired Balaam, the prophet from the east, to curse the Israelites? Balak thought he was pretty hot stuff. By the time God was done with him in Numbers 22, 3, and 4, he found out he wasn't. You remember Herod? This is Acts 12, Herod, who died and was eaten by worms. He thought he was somebody pretty special and finds out eventually that he's not. And Haman finds himself, I think, I don't know this because I haven't gotten past chapter 5, but I think Haman is going to find himself right in line with those other characters who thought they were really important and find out they're not. So Haman is really proud of himself. He's had a great day. He's expecting a great day tomorrow. And then this thorn in his flesh. Haman's egocentric flesh. The thorn in his flesh is whom? Mordecai, this Jew. What did Haman want more than anything? He had money that you couldn't count. It's like Scrooge McDuck. Haman had Heather says 10 sons. What more could you want? He had promotion after promotion. He had been advanced to the point where he actually spoke as if he had the authority of the king. And all of that paled into one thing. One thing Haman wanted. What was the one thing that would make him happy? Honor from Mordecai. Well, have Mordecai be dead. But on this day, honor from Mordecai. It's all it would take. No, it isn't all that would take. A guy like Haman is not going to be pleased when he gets what he wants. Well, Haman, after this spiel about how important he is, he finally gets a little bit of advice from his wife. Or as I put in my notes, that's what you get when you have a shrewd wife. I don't mean a shrew for a wife. I mean a shrewd wife. That's what you get when you have a shrewd wife. Look at verse 14. Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, let a gallows or a tree or a pole 50 cubits high, 75 feet, be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go joyfully with the king to the feast. This idea pleased Haman, and he had the gallows or the pole or the tree or the stake built. I wonder if Zeresh isn't responding out of frustration. You know, earlier she's thinking, Why do you let this Mordecai fellow spoil your day? Just kill him. Just get him out of the way. Murder him and then impale him on a pole that's 75 feet high, higher than the trees, higher than any building there in Susa. Put him on that pole so all the people can see what happens to those who don't adequately honor Haman. Just get this done, Ahasuerus, and then go on to the party and enjoy yourself. Apparently, Some of you live in a place where there are rules about what you can do. There's a homeowners association that tells you what you can and can't do. But apparently the homeowners association where Haman and Zeresh lived did not have any restrictions against building gallows. When I think about Zeresh's counsel, her advice to Haman, it reminds me of Jezebel and Ahab. You remember this story? Turn back with me to 1 Kings 21. I was going to say 2 Kings. To the left just a bit. I believe it's 1 Kings 21. I'll see when I get there. It is. 1 Kings chapter 21. You'll remember that Ahab took a liking to a vineyard owned by. In 1 Kings 21, Ahab, King Ahab, took a liking to a vineyard owned by Naboth. He said to Naboth, in verse 2, give me your vineyard. I want it for a vegetable garden. It's next to my house. I'll give you a better vineyard yet. And Naboth said in verse 3, no. Naboth took his inheritance rights seriously. He recognized that God had given that parcel of land to his ancestors, and therefore he was not going to sell it. Look at verse 4. Ahab went into his house vexed and sullen. You have to read it that way to get the point. Vexed and sullen because of what Naboth the Jezreelite had said to him, for he said, I will not give you the inheritance of my fathers. And Ahab lay on his bed and turned away his face and would eat no food. Remember the Patch the Pirate song? King Ahab went a-walking. The poochy lip disease. Jezebel, verse 5, his wife came to him and said to him, why are you pouting? That's a paraphrase. He said to her, because I spoke to Naboth the Jezreelite and said to him, give me your vineyard for money, or else if it please you, I'll give you another vineyard for it. And he said, I won't give it to you. Jezebel, his wife, said to him, you ninny, another paraphrase, do you not govern Israel? Arise and eat bread. Let your heart be cheerful. I'll take care of this for you. So she wrote letters in Ahab's name, sealed them with a seal, sent letters to the elders and the leaders who lived in the city of Naboth. Here's what she said. Proclaim a fast, set Naboth at the head of the people, set two worthless men opposite him, and let them bring a charge against him, saying, you've cursed God and the king, then take him out and stone him to death. The men of the city did this, and therefore the vineyard became available for King Ahab. That's the sort of counsel that Ahasuerus, or that Haman got from his wife. He needed help. Remember this morning, Greg, we were thinking together about Paul Tripp. And in his book, Instruments in the Redeemer's Hands, Tripp recognizes, as we did this morning in the Marriage Sunday School class, my self-perception is as accurate as a carnival mirror. I don't perceive myself well. I need help. C.J. Mahaney seconds Tripp's proposal. Without others' help, he says, to see myself clearly, I'll listen to my own arguments, believe my own lies, and buy into my own delusions. And Haman was doing exactly that. The problem was, the counsel he was getting was from Zeresh, who wanted him to be happy. If you see me really making a mess of my life, please do not seek to make me happy. Seek to make me holy. Confront me with my sin. As far as I know, I get to the end of chapter 5, and Esther is ignorant of the imminent danger facing Mordecai. What's going to happen first? Is Esther going to reveal her secret field with a runner on third base? What's going to happen here? Will the runner beat the throw, or will the ball be waiting in the catcher's glove when he reaches home plate? And then all of a sudden you lose reception. And you don't know how it's going to end. So far, this episode in the history of God's people has been full of surprises, and I'm eager to see what will await us next week in chapter 6. Haman has a lot of power. He's a powerful man, more powerful than all the rest of the officials in Persia. The king has raised him almost to a place where he is the king's peer. Who has more power, Haman or Esther? I'm not sure yet. But here's one thing I am sure of. Who has more power, Haman or God? God does.